From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. As we head into the new week, war seems like an apropos, even if sobering, theme. In France yesterday, world leaders marked the end of World War I, with the French president offering a rebuke of 2018-style nationalism. Back in Washington, a leading Democrat says he won't be taking a warlike posture with the president, but investigations are coming. In Florida and in Georgia, you could call the fight over vote recounts, well, if not a war, then at least a high-stakes political battle with enormous implications. And let's not forget firefighters and civilians battling deadly wildfires in California. This hour On Point, the news to watch this week. And you can join us. What do you make of President Trump's no-show at one Armistice Day commemoration in France and President Macron's pushback against nationalism? Georgia, Florida voters, what are you thinking with the lawsuits and the disputes over vote counts? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today from Washington is Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time. Molly, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be here.
And also with us is Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. And Sahil is also in Washington as well. It's good to have you back, Sahil.
Hey, Meghna. Good to be back.
So first of all, let's just start with the weekend's commemorations for the end of World War I, for Armistice that went on in France. Those commemorations happening this weekend. I actually want to start with the president himself. Just yesterday, on the 100th anniversary of Armistice, he did speak at Suresnes American Cemetery just outside of Paris.
Victory had come at a terrible cost. Among the Allied forces, more than 1 million French soldiers and 116,000 American service members had been killed by the war's end. Millions more were wounded. Countless would come home bearing the lasting scars of trench warfare and the grisly horrors of chemical weapons.
That's President Donald Trump just yesterday, just outside of Paris. Molly, contrast that to the controversy that erupted when the president did not come on Saturday to a commemoration at the cemetery that where many of the dead are buried following the Battle of Belleau Wood from the First World War. Lots of controversy about that.
Yeah, in a way, it seems like a silly controversy that the president, you know, arrived in Paris and then there was supposedly a bad weather call that grounded his helicopter and prevented him from making it to the site. But I think the reason it aroused so much commentary was that during the entire flight over to Paris, the president had been tweeting about the American election and spreading conspiracy theories about the vote counts. And so it seemed to perpetuate this idea that he's not particularly engaged in what's going on there in Paris. And indeed, with Macron's speech denouncing nationalism, there was yet again, and this has been a repeated pattern at meetings that President Trump has had with other European leaders, he seems to stand apart from that group, and they seem not to respect him very much, and the feeling appears to be mutual.
Yeah. Sahil, though, I mean, tell us what we know about exactly why the president didn't go to that commemoration on Saturday, because as Molly pointed out, the administration said there was a bad weather call, but we've had, you know, on Twitter, Ben Rhodes and others, former members of the Obama administration, for example, saying that there's always a rain. There's always a plan if there's rain or bad weather. So, and we had we had other heads of state go to this ceremony. So, what do we know? What really happened?
Well, the Trump administration, the White House, has cited the rain. Its critics have said, as you pointed out, that there is a way around that. That the president of the United States has the option, has a rain option, as Ben Rhodes called it. Beyond that, I don't think we really know. I think it's clear, as Molly pointed out, that the president's mind is elsewhere. It's been on the elections. And I was very struck by Emmanuel Macron's denunciation of nationalism, which seemed like a clear message to the president. When you're thinking about the World War, World War I, and obviously also the war that came after that, European leaders are very cognizant of that history and of the perils of nationalism and what it can do. And one thing that I found notable was that they appear also to have politics in their country that, you know, are motivating them to denounce President Trump. I'll just give you one number that speaks to this. The Pew Research Center has been doing research on this, on the United States, you know, favorable rating around the world. And it has gone from being favorable by 41 points at the end of the Obama administration to being unfavorable by 52 points at the beginning of the Trump administration. So that motivates world leaders to speak out against the United States and American, the American government in ways that they hadn't before.
Interesting. And also, I mean, as you just said, there are nationalistic impulses from the far right within the nations of all of these European countries that were gathered to commemorate the end of World War I. But since we've all mentioned Emmanuel Macron's speech, let's just hear a little bit of it. This is the French president yesterday at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. So you'll hear him speaking through an interpreter. And he stood before more than 60 world leaders there, including President Donald Trump and Russia's President Vladimir Putin.
Patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. Nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism by saying, our interests first, who cares about the others? We erase what a nation holds dearest, what gives it life, what makes it grace, and what is essential, its moral values.
That's French President Emmanuel Macron through an interpreter there. Molly, what was your reaction to this moment?
Well, it was not very subtle, yeah. Right? I mean, this is just a couple of weeks after Trump, for the first time, actually used the N-word, declared himself a nationalist. That's the N-word I'm referring to, yeah. To be clear. not the other one. I'm not accusing him of that. But, you know, so Trump has actually proclaimed himself a nationalist. This is a term that has historically had a negative connotation because it implies exactly what President Macron was describing, a turning inward, an isolation from the world, a putting of one's own interests above those of the world. And, you know, Trump has forcefully defended this point of view, saying we can't that globalism is bad and that for too long the United States and its leaders have put other countries' interests above their own and sort of sacrificed our own national well-being to help others around the globe. And this was, I think, a significant part of President Trump's appeal to many of those who voted for him. And it's always been a sort of strain of this in American politics. But as you mentioned, this is also something that has been sweeping the world. And when President Trump was elected, it was seen as a symptom of this larger spread of nationalism from Brexit to the elections in all over Europe. You know, Macron managed to win over a far-right candidate in France and Merkel in Germany. But still, these movements have been rising and becoming stronger in many European countries because of a lot of the same sentiments that Trump talks about, particularly borders and national identity. The idea that you can't be a country without a border and that these immigrants or refugees or people not like us who are coming in and changing the culture of many places, that is something that needs to be repelled. And so, you know, this is not a view that is shared. Trump's view is not one that is shared by most of the other European leaders. And he has gone in front of them in his first trip to Europe. He went in front of them and denounced their worldview. Mm-hmm. Now they're getting up in front of him and denouncing his.
Well, you know, so Sahil, Molly brings up a really interesting, I think, important point because taken one way, the president's sort of championing of nationalism, of populism, you know, has been successful both for his political career in the United States and, as Molly's pointing out, you know, in emboldening similar populists on the right in many countries around the world. So he can claim that as a success if he wants. But I also, at the same time, I find it still jarring that we can have this gathering of world leaders for, you know, an event such as commemorating a century after the end of World War I, and the president of the United States not playing a central role in that. I mean, it's pomp and circumstance on the one hand, but it's also a meaningful visual representation of where America stands vis-a-vis its allies right now. And so, I mean, is there a way to square those two? I find it still jarring to this day.
Right. Well, President Trump can certainly claim, you know, his worldview, his nationalist, populist, nativist worldview as a domestic political success. And we see throughout history these impulses have political valence. They work. You know, people respond to them, especially in difficult times, especially, for instance, here in an economy where median wages have stagnated for decades and people are always looking for some sort of new change. We've seen this throughout Europe, throughout European history. And I found the venue that they chose, that Emmanuel Macron chose to make this denunciation, it was, as Molly said, it was not subtle at all. We knew exactly what he was referring to, which is that nationalism has led to some of the worst wars and some of the deadliest bloodshed in European history. And we are not going back to that. Now, Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel of Germany are institutionalists who have been pushing back against these impulses in Europe that, you know, as I mentioned, have been there for a very long time, but are now sprouting up all over the place.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's where there is a big contrast between where those European leaders are and where President Trump is. Where President Trump is not where any American president since the end of World War II has been. United States presidents have traditionally not called themselves nationalists, have respected international institutions and the global order that was built after World War II to prevent another such catastrophe.
It just makes me wonder, Molly. I mean, we've just got 30 seconds here to go before the break, but I was watching events this weekend and wondering, why is it that the conversation worldwide seems to now be split between closed-border nationalism and seemingly, you know, open market? It's globalism. There's got to be some sort of middle ground there. And which world leader is championing that middle ground?
Well, and I think a lot of the globalists would claim that they are seeking not actually, you know, complete open borders, but some kind of middle ground. But there has been, I think it is actually a mark of the success of globalism and international institutions that they're now arousing this backlash because they have moved so quickly to accomplish so much.
All right. Well, that was a look at events of this weekend commemorating the end of the First World War. When we come back, we'll take a look at the many battles being fought here in the United States, both political and physical, natural battles going on with wildfires in California. I'm joined today by Molly Ball. She's national political correspondent for Time. Sahil Kapoor is also with us. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg News. And we want to hear from you. What's on your mind as Florida engages in a recount, as the Georgia gubernatorial race is still undecided? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with top reporters this hour about what to look for and understand in the week ahead. Molly Ball is with us. She's national political correspondent for Time. And Sahil Kapoor also joins us. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. And let's land right in Florida now, or at least with issues regarding the Florida election. A lot still undecided there following the midterms this week. There is a recount going on in Florida, and people are definitely looking at the Senate and gubernatorial race down there. Many heated passions around this. So first of all, let's hear South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham speaking to Fox News' Sean Hannity on Friday. And Senator Graham compared the contested Florida Senate race between Rick Scott and Bill Nelson to the confirmation fight over Brett Kavanaugh.
When it comes to counting votes and confirming judges, there's nothing Democrats won't do to win. They tried to destroy Brett Kavanaugh. It didn't work. They're trying to steal this election. It's not going to work. The law means nothing to liberal Democrats. It's all about outcome. And they're not going to win.
Lindsey,
they didn't destroy Kavanaugh. And they're not going to screw Rick Scott.
That's Senator Lindsey Graham on Fox News on Friday. Well, on Saturday, in a press conference, Eugene Pettis, lawyer for Broward County Supervisor of Elections Brenda Snipes, Snipes' lawyer responded to claims being made, of claims of fraud against Snipes.
There have been allegations of fraud. Those are serious charges to recklessly offer out there. There's no basis for it. To give a claim of fraud without any evidence, I think, is unacceptable.
Again, that's Eugene Pettis, lawyer for Broward County Supervisor of Elections, Brenda Snipes. And there have been claims made, as you heard there, of fraud in Broward County vote count with no evidence being given. Sahil Kapoor, what is going on in Florida?
Well, what's happening is what has happened in Florida before. There are those two races that you talked about, the governor's race and the Senate race. The margin is under 0.5%, and under state law, those go to a recount. There's also, by the way, the agriculture commissioner's race that's going to a recount. But of course, all eyes are on the governor's race and the Senate race. There is no evidence of fraud in Florida at this point. There's no evidence of, you know, that votes were mistabulated or miscast that Rick Scott has been talking about, that the Democrats are trying to steal the election. What there are some instances of potential irregularities, particularly in Broward County. One example is this big gap of about 25,000 votes where, you know, people voted for governor and 25,000 fewer people voted for senator. That's highly unlikely on a marquee top ticket race. And what Republicans are pointing to is the Broward County's elections office's troubled history, most notably something like 2016, where the supervisor of those elections was chastised by a judge for breaking the law by destroying ballots after the election sooner than she was supposed to. But there's no evidence in this case that the election is being stolen. This is overheated rhetoric that is prejudging the outcome of the election. At this point, Rick Scott, the Republican, leads by about 16,000 votes. That's a tiny margin among the 8 million ballots that are cast. And the governor's race, Andrew Gillum, the Democrat who had conceded on election night when it looked like it was out of reach for him, has sort of unconceded.
Yeah.
He is down now by about 33,000 votes. He has a steeper hill to climb than Bill Nelson, the Senate Democrat. But that race is also going to a recount.
Well, Molly Ball, though, I mean, for example, in the Rick Scott Bill Nelson race, there's a big push here to come to some sort of conclusion through the courts, right? I'm seeing that Rick Scott is filing three lawsuits against county election officials, specifically Broward County, as Sahil just pointed out. I mean, so this is serious. It's not just a matter of Florida being Florida.
Yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable to hear the rhetoric coming from Rick Scott and others such as Lindsey Graham and Florida Senator Marco Rubio jumping to this fraud accusation without any evidence. I think the normal sort of politically correct, if you will, thing to do would be to take a step back and say, let's let them count the votes. Let's all calm down. Let's all have faith in the process and see where it leads. But instead, you know, starting with the president himself, there was this leap to conclusions, this accusation of fraud in Arizona as well, where Democratic and Republican officials have said the count is proceeding in a normal fashion. Nonetheless, the president has also asserted that there's fraud going on there. And that really hurts public confidence in elections. That really hurts public confidence in the entire government when, top leaders are encouraging people to believe what I think, honestly, at this point has to be called a conspiracy theory. As Sahil said, there is potential incompetence, but the head of the Broward County elections, this is someone who was appointed by a Republican governor, Jeb Bush, and who has overseen multiple elections that Republicans won by narrow margins. Now, frequently has had problems getting the vote count done in a timely fashion. But that didn't seem to be a problem when it was Republicans coming out ahead. So I think there's a lot of questions about whether this recount can actually be done, you know, in a cool and neutral fashion, given all of the pressure that's being put on it and all of the rhetoric that's flying around.
Mm. I'll add to that, Meghna, briefly,
yeah,
that Governor Rick Scott's own election monitors in his administration have said they see no evidence of criminal activity or fraud at this time. So that is, Governor Scott and President Trump getting way ahead of themselves.
Does it concern you? I mean, I can hear the concern in Molly's voice, but Sahil, just checking in with you. I mean, I feel that we can have contested elections. We do regularly in the United States now. But for sides to jump so quickly to this idea of fraud, or I mean, we're hearing people say stealing elections. I mean, as Molly said, what can that do other than undermine confidence?
There can be no institution more sacred than the integrity of elections in the United States. The way this country has worked is people can fight it out at the ballot box, on the campaign trail, but once the results are in, they are respected. And if the public does not have confidence in that, then that can sprout all kinds of problems.
We are talking about the week ahead in the news, focusing on Florida and Georgia here in just a second. But let's go to Jackie, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a Democrat, and I'm ready for this to be over. It feels like it all over again. The whole race was a completely contentious, completely like felt like hostile all the time, in your face. And now it feels like that all over again. And when I heard DeSantis won, when it was first, I was like, okay, my heart's broken. You know, I really wanted Gillian to win, but okay, let's see where this goes. But then all of a sudden here comes this new, this thing. And because it's in the margin, it should be counted. But I feel like there's such an idea of this influence of Trumpism where it's a conspiracy theory, and it feels like we're never going to get out of this sort of cycle. And, Florida feels like I don't want to speak for everybody, but it's like, honestly, it is shaking confidence. Mm. And, I'm a Democrat, obviously my heart's broken, but on top of that, I feel like there's sore winners with Republicans right now.
Right.
So it just feels like it's never ending.
Well, Jackie, thank you so much for your call. Molly Ball, I hear Jackie's weariness already in being a Florida voter. but I mean, we've seen this before. I mean, I'm having flashbacks of 2000, right? This could go on for a long time.
We've seen this before, although a lot of people haven't, right? I mean, people who were born during the last Florida recount are now old enough to vote.
Yeah.
So there is
You're
a whole generation that doesn't have the PTSD that you and I do about recounts in Florida. I think also people maybe have unrealistic expectations about the way elections work in our country now. I mean, I wasn't alive 200 years ago, but it used to be that it took months for, all the, I guess, horses carrying the ballots or the electors or whatever to get to Washington and figure out who won an election. It's there's so many ways for people to vote, and states have so many different methods of counting and tabulating them that it is absolutely normal to not know the precise number of votes it's been less than a week after the election. We're so used to election night in America and having everything decided. In California, there's a lot of races still to be called, and that's normal for California elections because of the way that they allow people to vote and the way that they tabulate ballots. But people somehow think that these must be, new votes coming out of nowhere because you looked on election night and it said 100% of precincts reporting or whatever.
Right.
I think the bigger picture, though, going back to 2000, is that there was such a clear breakdown in the system after that. There was such a clear need for reform. And Congress did pass a sweeping election reform law, but there were a lot of flaws in that legislation, and there were a lot of flaws in the system that went unaddressed. And because politicians are put into power by the systems that exist, they perhaps don't have an incentive to fix those systems. So we're seeing that America's election systems are still pretty badly broken. There's such a patchwork of local administrators all over the country using different methods, having different amounts of resources. Election security, obviously, is also an issue. And if it is an issue, it's largely because politicians haven't stepped up and fixed it.
Mm. Well, I just want to circle back here for a quick second to the language around this Florida recount right now, because as both of you mentioned, the president just tweeted this morning, quote, "The Florida election should be called in favor of Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis in that large numbers of new ballots showed up, quote, out of nowhere, and many ballots are missing or forged. An honest vote count is no longer possible. Ballots massively infected. Must go with election night," end quote. That's from the president. He's not offering any evidence for some of his claims here regarding these ballots. But Sahil Kapoor, I mean, have we ever had a president just call for, you know, go with the election night results and ignore maybe the absentee ballots or the votes that haven't been counted?
Well, one of the interesting things there is I already see Democrats on Twitter pointing out that if the election were to be called now and the remaining ballots not cast, that would mean military service members who are abroad and who sent their absentee ballots would not have their votes counted. So that's one argument you can make on this. But as you mentioned, there is no evidence for the president's claims. And you mentioned 2000. The interesting thing there was that it was a bitterly fought election. It was a bitterly fought recount in Florida, lawsuits all the way up to the Supreme Court. At the end of it, Al Gore, who believed he deserved to win that election and believed he had actually won, decided to concede to preserve Americans' confidence in the integrity of their elections and not to prolong, you know, a situation where we don't know who the next president is going to be. That has been the conduct in the past of people who lose very close contested elections. And by the way, the lame duck period continues for until January 3rd. The next senator is not going to be sworn in from Florida until January 3rd of 2019. So there is a bit of time.
Mm. Let's go to Wayne, who's calling from Toronto, Canada. Wayne, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a quick comment and then a question. Obviously, I'm a foreign observer here, but people say there's no evidence, but aren't investigations supposed to uncover evidence? Because after all, if you had evidence already, then you wouldn't need an investigation. You'd need a grand jury. Now, my question is, I know you're talking about Gore versus Bush, and I remember that in Florida. It seemed the longer it went on, the closer Gore got.
Mm-hmm.
And now I look at the four races in question, two in Florida, Georgia, and Arizona, and on election night, the Republicans were ahead in all those races. And now it seems the longer it goes on, the closer the Democrats creep. And my question is, a casual observer would assume the same vote distribution for uncounted ballots as those that have been counted. But it's not like you have a secret stash of Democrat ballots to break glass in case of a close election. But doesn't the result seem to be similar as
right.
if that had been the case?
So you're wondering why the margin gets tighter. Wayne, thank you for your call. Molly, do you have an answer for him?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are instances as well of a Republican taking the lead after all of the after more ballots are counted after the close of the polls. A congressional election in Texas, for example, where the Republican appears to have won despite trailing in the early vote count. So it isn't the case that this only ever benefits Democrats. I think it is benefiting Democrats or has in these cases, partly because the largest jurisdictions with the most population, the most votes to count, and therefore the most provisional ballots, absentee ballots, and so on, those tend to be large urban areas, and that's where Democrats votes are concentrated. So in a place like Miami-Dade or Broward County, this is a large urban location where Democrats rack up their margins. This is where Democrats draw most of their vote strength in Florida elections. And that's just a fact of geography. So, but of course, there should be an investigation. There should always, we should never rule out the possibility that something has happened. And law enforcement is fully equipped to chase down any particular allegations. The problem is the Florida law enforcement authorities have said they don't even have any leads to pursue
right.
in this case because no one has actually pointed to any potential instances of fraud as opposed to, you know, things like coincidences or just a general feeling that someone's getting screwed, as Lindsey Graham would say. So I think the lawsuits will ensure that the facts are uncovered and that the investigation is done. And we should, of course, preserve an open mind for whatever comes out of that.
Yeah. Sahil, let's move over to Georgia here briefly, because in that state, of course, the gubernatorial race is still being deeply contested. And I'm seeing here that Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams, her campaign has filed a federal lawsuit. They did so yesterday, asking a judge to delay some vote certifications until Wednesday, I believe, so they could restore a little over 1,000 votes that weren't counted. So what's happening in Georgia?
Right. Well, this is an instance where there does appear to be an array of reports about actual irregularities.
Right.
There's the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is reporting that a poll worker in Atlanta was doling out ballots to select voters and turning others away. There were others who said they were waiting for hours on election day to vote in the Atlanta metropolitan area, which is a strongly Democratic area in the state. And and a lot of them went away that morning and did not end up coming back to cast their ballots. So there have been suspicions and there have been reports of potential irregularities. There are no reports, no evidence yet of fraud necessarily occurring. And the Republican there, Brian Kemp, is the Secretary of State who oversees elections, which I think is adding to the suspicions people have. This race has not been called yet. By the latest count I'm looking right now, he appears to be leading by about 60,000 mm-hmm. votes. So Stacey Abrams, the Democrat, has a very steep hill to climb there. But she and her allies are filing suit and trying to make sure that all.
Sahil, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, good. Looks like we just lost you for one quick second there, but got you back. And we are talking about the news to watch this week. We were just discussing Florida and Georgia, and we want to know what you think about these vote counts, about lawsuits regarding trying to find an end to these elections. And I have a question. Why do we insist on knowing who winners are at the end of election night? As Molly Ball was pointing out earlier, we should take a little bit of more time, perhaps. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what to watch for in the coming week. And I'm joined today by Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Sahil Kapoor is also with us. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. And Molly, just before the break, Sahil was telling us that in Georgia, about that gubernatorial race, that Kemp currently has about a 60,000 vote lead over Abrams. But I'm also seeing here that the Abrams campaign is saying that if they can get that margin down to 22,000 votes, roughly, that would force the runoff, which is one of the reasons why, perhaps the main reason why they're contesting in terms of the number of ballots remaining to be counted. So, I mean, what do you think may happen in the coming days in Georgia?
I have no idea. I don't want to pretend to know what's going to. No, I mean, I really think this could go a number of different ways. As you mentioned, in Georgia, the way elections work is if one candidate gets 50% of the vote, that candidate wins. But if neither candidate gets 50%, it does go to a runoff several weeks later. And there is a time pressure here because there is a deadline for those votes to be counted to decide whether the runoff is triggered. But Stacey Abrams has been raising allegations of election meddling throughout this election. This didn't only become an issue when it became convenient for her, because Brian Kemp, as the Secretary of State, has been the official responsible for overseeing elections in Georgia. And Abrams and her supporters have argued that that was always a conflict of interest. And I think the conventional thing for Kemp to do would have been to step down so that he wasn't overseeing his own election in what was sure to be a tight and nasty race for governor. But he didn't. And I think that has opened the door for more concerns about what may have happened, along with reports during the election of, thousands of voter registrations being purged or not accepted. A lot of anecdotal reports that the Abrams campaign is now collecting and that surely will come to light in the course of this lawsuit that they've brought.
Well, let's go to Marty, who's calling from Janesville, Wisconsin. Marty, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. To me, I'm going to posit that the Republican Party is starting to quake in their boots, and this is evidenced by Lindsey Graham and Rick Scott starting to throw their toys around in a sandbox. The Republicans have all boarded the Trump Titanic, and now it's starting to list. And with any hope, this baby's going to sink come 2020.
So you think that's why we have the accusations of voter fraud, Marty? Looks like Marty has had his say. So let's go to John, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment is more about the media coverage surrounding the election fraud issue. What's happening in this country is an all-out assault on democracy, our democratic institutions, from the Supreme Court down to our very elections. And the media has no way of talking about it. They consistently rely on old themes of both sides are doing it. Why are both sides causing problems? It's not a both sides issue. Even one of your guests was referring all the to all the claims having to be investigated in Florida. There's no evidence that there's any corruption of any kind in Florida. And the host, the NPR host, even earlier said both sides are so quick to make these claims. It's not both sides. Only one side is doing it, and the media has to find a way to talk about the fact that this country's democracy is under assault. Thank you.
John, thank you for your call. Molly, I think that's John taking both you and me to task here. How do you want to respond to him?
I don't think he was listening to the show. If he did, he would have gotten a clear understanding from our comments of exactly which side is to blame in which instances. But it isn't our job to take sides. It's our job to report accurately on what's happening. And with all due respect to that listener, I believe we do have the tools to do that, and we are doing it, and we have been doing it. And sometimes that will lead to election results that some people like, and sometimes it will lead to election results that they don't. But we're doing our job, which is to tell the truth.
Yeah, I don't think that I see any equivocation in our conversation here today. Well, let's but you know, actually, I don't want to just dismiss John out of hand. So John, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Because Sahil, let me bring you into this, because I think a lot of people do hear conversations, you know, such as ours, and whether or not they're, you know, training 100% of their attention on the conversation kind of depends, or in the press, or especially on TV, on cable TV, and they do feel as if there is sort of a both sides conversation when it comes to how the media talks about election results. I think some of that criticism is fair. But I just want to know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, in this case, we should be clear, and I believe we have been clear, that there is no evidence of the allegations that are being made by President Trump and Governor Rick Scott. So, yes, I think it's extremely important that we, you know, that the press, when reporting on this, points out points out who is making allegations, where the evidence actually is, and not, you know, and doesn't conflate the other side that isn't doing it with the side that is doing it. I believe we have done that on the show, and I completely understand and sympathize with those who say it's important that the press be clear on this.
Yeah. Well, I always appreciate callers calling in and definitely letting us know what they think about the jobs that we do. But let's move on to another very important story that we need to keep our eyes on in the coming days and weeks. And this has to do with the new acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker. First of all, we have Kellyanne Conway here, counselor to the president, on Fox News on Sunday, distancing the president from Whitaker's past attacks on the Mueller investigation.
The president said he has not discussed the Mueller investigation with Whitaker. He's made that very clear the other day. I believe somebody asked him that question. I've never been witness to them discussing it, and I'll go a little bit farther. It would be a mistake to try to shut down the Mueller investigation in the way that you describe it, because we've been so compliant.
Well, that's Kellyanne Conway on Fox News on Sunday. And Matt Whitaker, of course, in the past, amongst his several comments about the Mueller investigation, has said that he'd like to see it grind to a halt. So we have New York Democrat Gerald Nadler. He's going to be the next chair of the House Judiciary Committee. And on ABC's This Week, just yesterday, host George Stephanopoulos asked Congressman Nadler about what he thinks of Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker.
If Matt Whitaker is still the acting attorney general when you become chair of the Judiciary Committee,
we will make sure that Matt Whitaker immediately, one of our first orders of business will be to invite him, and if necessary, to subpoena him to appear before the committee.
Okay, Sahil Kapoor, tell us where we are on the latest on Whitaker and his appointment as acting attorney general.
Right. Well, the president, as has long been suspected, ousted Attorney General Jeff Sessions. He submitted his resignation, and the first line of that resignation was, "At your request, I am submitting my resignation."
Right.
So there's no real doubt that Sessions was pushed out. And now Matt Whitaker, who has been the chief of staff to Sessions, has been appointed acting attorney general. This has raised all sorts of red flags, particularly among critics of the administration, specifically because of Whitaker's past remarks criticizing the Mueller investigation. He has said on various occasions things like it's gone too far. He's talked about, you know, a red line being crossed potentially by Mueller in terms of looking into the president's finances. He has suggested that the Mueller investigation does not necessarily have to be terminated to be nullified. It could just be choked off in terms of resources. You know, and he's also had some very sharp, some sort of radical ideas in terms of jurisprudence. For instance, he has said that Marbury versus Madison, the 2-century-old Supreme Court ruling establishing judicial review, basically where the courts get to decide what's constitutional and what's not, he has said that's a bad idea. He's talked about New Deal jurisprudence that established federal authority to regulate interstate commerce. He said those rulings were a bad idea. So I think all of these issues are coming forth in terms of whether Matt Whitaker should be acting attorney general and should have that job going forward.
Well, so
and of course, there are legal questions as well, I should add, about the president's appointment. Some people think it was unconstitutional because Whitaker is, as attorney general, that's a principal officer. And the argument is that the Senate needs to confirm such a person.
Exactly. So that's actually what I was going to ask Molly, because, I mean, those concerns about the legality of Whitaker's appointment seem to actually be growing in some quarters.
Yeah, and the White House appears to have been somewhat blindsided by some of this, although I can't sane person should have known that this was going to be hugely controversial, and they've been preparing for this for upwards of a year since the president has been so dissatisfied with Jeff Sessions. But Sahil did a good job of outlining, I think, the three different buckets of Democratic complaints about Whitaker. On number one, his qualifications; number two, the way he was appointed; and number three, the views that he's expressed, both on the Mueller investigation and on general legal issues. The Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, has said that he doesn't expect this person to come before the Senate for confirmation. He expects this to only be an interim appointment until a nomination can be made of someone who the administration actually wants to serve as attorney general. That is going to be a really difficult process, too. And I think if we take another step back, this is really a sign of things to come, that for the last 2 years, the president has done all kinds of things that Democrats didn't like and thought were legally questionable, but all they could really do was go on cable news and complain. Starting in January, they're going to have subpoena power. So anytime the president does something that Democrats believe is unconstitutional or illegal or whatever, they're going to be able to investigate it, as they've just threatened with Whitaker. So it's going to be harder for President Trump to simply do whatever he wants, which he was basically able to do with a Republican Congress that didn't seek to rein him in very much.
Mm. Talking about the news to look out for in the week ahead. So let's go to Jim, who's calling from Ludlow, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Just a comment back on the election result. The point I'd like to make is this is all part of the game plan. If you go back to 2016, just literally day prior to the election, Trump was asked in a major press conference, are you going to honor the results of the election? He quite simply said, we'll see, we'll see. So the game plan is, we don't win, we cry foul. There is no evidence. That's why they create the evidence with this statement. Mm. It's all, and what Trump has now is a compliant Republican Party, the powers that be, that say, let's ride this until we can.
Right.
We can't stand around and let the most essential part of a democracy, which is free elections and a free media, be undermined in this manner.
Jim, thank you so much for your call. Sahil, did you want to just respond quickly to Jim? He sees it as an inevitability, the language from the president around the midterm elections.
Well, I mean, there is a pattern with President Trump in that he has not been hesitant to undermine institutions that he doesn't believe are serving him. And your caller was right in the sense that President Trump did not say before the election whether he would accept the result. There were a lot of conspiracy theories, and it wasn't just him. I remember being at his rallies ahead of Election Day in 2016, where many of his supporters bought into that idea that if the election did not go his way, that there would have been, there would have been fraud. It would have been illegitimate, and they may not have accepted the results. And these things have enormous consequences, I think, to undermine faith in the legitimacy of American elections.
Yeah. Well, in the last couple of minutes that we have here, I want to switch gears entirely because we do need to talk about the immense battles that are going on in California over the state's largest fires there, at least in 80 years, most deadly. More than 4,000 firefighters are battling the Camp Fire in Northern California. The town of Paradise there was essentially wiped off the map by these fires. NBC News was with 30-year resident Jim Clarkson yesterday when he discovered his home was gone.
You could see over here what it was like. It was gorgeous. Just start over, you know. Yeah, that's the tough part about living in paradise is, you know, there's fires that come through.
And they're coming through more often, they're bigger, and they're hotter with every passing year. Molly Ball, your thoughts on the California fires we're seeing right now?
Well, it's obviously a heartbreaking situation. A couple of dozen, I believe, already have died from this. It is, as you mentioned, something that happens every year and that seems to get worse. And so that raises all kinds of questions about the role of climate change. And not to make everything political, but the president also jumped in to comment on this. And rather than offer any kind of solace or comfort to those who have lost loved ones or property, he immediately sought to find someone to blame. He immediately claimed that this was all the part of the officials who should have been practicing better forest management. So, and I'm not aware that forest management has been an area of emphasis for the Trump administration in terms of their trying to reform processes or provide more resources to states like California. So I think that hit a sour note for a lot of the people who are dealing with tremendous loss in California.
Sahil, your thoughts?
We may be looking at a situation, in fact, we probably will be, where Congress may need to appropriate some funds for disaster relief. And the incoming Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, is a Californian. She will likely be the point person on that. She released a statement after the wildfires saying that the people of California deserve to know that Congress will be there for them now and throughout the long road to recovery. I will say, you know, California wildfires are, in general, nothing new, but just personally on an anecdotal level, I've heard more about this one than any other one. I have friends and family that have had to evacuate. One person I know had their place of work in Malibu burnt to the ground. Others I know in the LA area are staying home because the air is so difficult to breathe. So this is a level beyond what we usually see with California wildfires. It sounds pretty awful.
Yeah, and I just want to say that tomorrow we're going to be spending the whole hour talking about them because whether it's climate change, development, forest management, you name it, there are a lot of human causes behind what's essentially a year-round fire season in places like California now. So we're going to spend an hour talking about that tomorrow. Molly and Sahil, we've just got a couple seconds left here. One last little thing I wanted to ask you about. You have any thoughts on Michelle Obama's book, which is coming out tomorrow? She's been speaking recently. Are you looking forward to it or any thoughts about that, Molly?
Well, it is interesting to me how it has it brought up again the old controversies that were Donald Trump's entree into this political season, which was talking about the false birther conspiracy theory and ginning up antagonism among Republicans against Obama, which I think is the reason that he was immediately so successful among Republican voters.
Yeah. And Sahil, you got about 15 seconds.
Well, I was struck by the fact that she said she would never forgive President Trump for stoking the so-called birther conspiracy theories about, you know, her husband allegedly not being born in this country. He was. And she argued that endangered her and her two daughters.
Right. Well, Sahil Kapoor and Molly Ball, it's always great to have both of you. Thank you for helping set us all up for this week. Thank you so very much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.